Not in the beginning, that's right. Previously, I hadn't had technology, I'm not sure. But sometimes, if they work it right, I can talk.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Actually, I'm going to communicate with him. Let's not talk anymore. This is Dr. Peter Bregan, and welcome to my show, the Peter Bregan Hour. My guest today is Martha Rosenberg. She's been on before. If you've heard her before, you're going to want to hear her again. But I thought I'd catch you up on some insider information, which is probably not so insider, but which you haven't heard. The James Holmes trial, this incredible tragedy at Aurora Theater, where he murdered many people and wounded dozens, is over. And apparently, during the phase where they determine whether or not he was going to have the death penalty, there was at least one juror as a holdout, and so he did not get the death penalty, which was a major goal that the defense had set. I don't think they expected to win the not guilty by reason of insanity, because when you have such a horrendous crime, jurors aren't going to let a person off. But they did prevent the death penalty, and that's all they could have expected. Now, what they didn't do was to make an issue of psychiatric drugs. So I just want to give you briefly what his psychiatric drug exposure was. I believe this information is available on the record because there was an open trial. But I have it because I was an expert in the case in the beginning and got a lot of information, reviewed the records before they decided not to go ahead and build a plea around his drug exposure. I don't know if they did that just out of practicality, or if they were pressured in some way not to get into making the drugs a culprit, which, of course, the establishment does not want to happen. Well, what was James Holmes' exposure? On March 21st, 2012, 141 days before this horrific event, he went to his university. He was a graduate student. Neuroscience. He went to his university clinic, and on the first visit, March 21st, 2012, he told the psychiatrist that he had thoughts about killing people. He was looking for help, and he hinted that he was even had ideas he didn't want to share with them. Well, the psychiatrist was alerted and did call and try to get a consultation to help her out, make some decisions. Eventually, she alerted the police, but they did not follow up. When he dropped out of school, they did not follow up, so he was lost. But what she did do most dramatically on March 21st was she started him on Zoloft, the antidepressant sertraline, which is known to cause violence. It's been correlated with violence in the study. You can Google it by Thomas Moore. On F reports to the FDA. It's one of the highly rated drugs for reports of violence per prescription. Then on the 27th, while he got worse, his Zoloft was increased to from 50 to 100 milligrams. On April 27th, it was increased to 150 milligrams. And on June 30th, he dropped out of school and abruptly stopped it. And that's when they lost track of him. That was 20 days before he committed the violent acts. So he had 121 days of exposure, 20 days of withdrawal. By then, and I have my own impression, but also a couple of really inside sources who have told me, as well as my own impression of the records, that he was not planning mass violence until he got onto Zoloft. He was harboring violence. He maybe had been thinking about violence all of his life, for all we know. But we don't know that he had any mass plans. He wasn't buying things. He wasn't organizing an assault until he was put on Zoloft. I think it probably turned him into a case of psychotic mania on top of the fact that he was already a time bomb. And then, as I said, probably in a mixed state of toxicity and withdrawal, he then committed this most violent crime. I think there's a couple of lessons from this. One, psychiatry does not protect us from violence. Even when somebody says they're violent, they get listed as having homicidal ideation, and when they appear extremely anxious, psychiatry is no protection. And indeed, psychiatry is likely to add fuel to the fire with a drug like Zoloft, which makes many people more anxious and agitated, which was his state, and which makes some people just grossly psychotic. So psychiatry doesn't help, and it often harms in these situations. Now, notice you haven't heard about this in the press. You haven't been seeing blogs about this. But the information is surely available from the trial, but nobody's picking up on it. Nobody wants to talk about it. So we have one more mass murder in which an antidepressant played, I think, a significant role. That's it for my little intro here. Now to my guest, Martha Rosenberg. Hi, Martha. You there?
Well, hi there, Dr. Bregan. Hi, I'm so happy to be with you.
I'm glad you're here. Martha, call me Peter, as we do when we talk
informally. I will.
Martha is an investigative health reporter. She contributes to Consumer Reports, to Bill Moyer's new site. She contributes to the Annenberg Health site at the University of California. She's had major appearances on C-SPAN and NPR. She even gets a lecture at medical schools. I'd like to hear about that, where she talks to them about the problems with direct-to-consumer marketing. Martha has a very good book out, Born with a Junk Food Deficiency. I love the title. It's received a lot of praise and some awards, Born with a Junk Food Deficiency. And she's recently gotten into a new area, the multidisciplinary management of chronic pain. And she got into that area by editing a book that will be coming out under the name of, as it should, the physician author. But she's played a role in developing that book. So we may go in a lot of different directions today, all of them interesting. So Martha Rosenberg, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Peter. You know, I certainly heard what you've said about the Aurora shooter. And I do cover or follow gun violence, these mass shootings, and the Virginia Tech shooter and the Northern Illinois shooter were also both either on or coming off SSRIs, and I'm sure there's many, many more. And as you said...
Oh, Eric Harris. I was an expert in cases, Martha, surrounding Eric Harris, the Columbine shooter, and probably the leader of the two boys. And I followed his medical records from his having some problems with OCD to being put on this drug to becoming a crazy person, crazy, violent, psychotic person. He was put on Luvox. And there's advanced literature on Luvox causing psychosis. Did you pick up anywhere in the media the material I just gave our audience?
No, absolutely not. And if it were covered, you're the first person to really mention it that I've heard, but I would have noticed it right away because we were all watching that bloodshed that summer and wondering. And another thing that I marvel at is how somebody with these clear problems and history of, you know, what he had, could just buy all the guns he wanted and all the ammunition he wanted when, as you said, he was a time bomb. You know, so that is another issue, too.
No doubt about it. I'm not sure what in the world we can do exactly about that. And I'm not sure I want to go too far with that right now. But
well, I know that's
availability of guns. As much as I am somebody who believes in the right to keep and bear arms, availability of arms no doubt increases the lethal capacity of people. There's no way around that. No way at all around it.
Well, the homicide and the suicide, it's such a quick way when you're angry. You know, we always say, those of us against gun violence, that you can't stab 72 people in 1 minute like the Aurora shot. You know, so, yeah, people are angry, and they'll get a weapon, but there's nothing like a gun when, you know, for just mass carnage like that. One thing I wanted to talk about that's related to, really related to Holmes and Aurora. About 2 weeks ago, the New York Times ran an article in its magazine about suicide on campus. And, I've been covering suicide as a side effect of psychiatric drugs for a long time. Anybody who's interested in a lot more about it can buy my book or get it from the public library. And so I've been intrigued with how it's misinterpreted or how the media doesn't really accurately cover what you and I both know is going on. And one example, of course, is the military suicides. I've been saying this now for 4 years, but 38% of the military suicide people, soldiers, have never deployed, and something like 62% never saw combat. But the 38% of never deployed is, in my opinion, a very clear indication that there's something else going on. It's not combat. It's not deployment stress. Military Times, which is a really good publication, estimates that 1 out of 6 service people is on psychoactive drugs. So, you know, I feel the military suicides have everything to do with how drugged up these people are. And I know you've talked a lot about that previously, so I'm sure you can say something here about even testifying on that.
Yeah, it's a real tragedy. Often they're given these drugs for PTSD, and these drugs don't help people with PTSD. The way they were tested, a couple of them got approved for PTSD, and the way they were tested were by giving them for a few weeks to people who had been suffering from PTSD for 12 years or more, I mean, really long, chronic patients, and claiming that they felt better on some parameters for a little while because they're numbing agents. They were not given anywhere near when treatment starts. And even the VA now is discouraging their use for PTSD, but I don't know how much it's going to affect things. And most of these soldiers, you know, they end up on cocktails of drugs, which ruin their frontal lobe function, may give them lots of painful emotions, numb them, and just do a lot of things that can lead to violence and suicide. And, of course, as Fred Bauman, the neurologist, has been pointing out, also leads to sudden death in healthy young men and women.
Well, you're exactly right. And it's not covered as it should be by the press. In your book, which I really got so much out of, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, I had really no idea how long it takes to get off these drugs, how quickly they're put on. Well, we'll add another, you'll go on a cocktail, and then years to get off these drugs. And the cocktails, of course, are not tested together. You know, we know that, you know, that before FDA approval, the drugs are tested by themselves. We also know that some of these young soldiers are also going to drink and they're going to do street drugs. And who knows what is in their body with these, from the cocktails of drugs that they're on. And even we've talked about the malaria drug, lyrium, which is also violence-producing. So the military suicides I have been covering for a long time and wondered why we periodically hear reports, sometimes in JAMA or a medical journal, and they'll say, well, we think it's their pre-existing personalities and all these reasons why they've killed themselves. And when you look at who wrote these are doctors and authors who are funded by Big Pharma. So, of course, they're not even going to look at is it the drugs, much less conclude that it is. So I've covered the military suicides for several years, and about 2 weeks ago, New York Times talked about the campus suicides. Well, yeah, we know that there's more suicides on campus than anybody would want to see. But they named a group called Active Minds as an advocacy group, which they kind of implied, the New York Times did, was helping this issue. Well, you know, you and I have talked a lot about NAMI and the pharma front groups. Well, Active Minds is a pharma front group. And what it will do is when there's suicides on a campus, it will swoop down and it will say, well, the problem here is your SSRI deficiency. And they'll literally use campus suicides to sell their agenda.
I'm so glad you're talking about this. Say some more about it. What do we know of their drug company? And this is new for me, folks, so this is really important. What do we know of this Active Mind? What a great name. What do we know about their company connections?
I'm located on the right near the Northwestern campus in Evanston, and we had two suicides that occurred here. I think it was 2012, and out of nowhere comes this group, Active Minds, and they're saying, "Well, this is a failure of the health system." Well, you know, they had the SSRI deficiency. They don't, of course, put it like that. But they swoop down upon Northwestern, and they're on actually 100 campuses. They are funded by AstraZeneca, Eli Lilly, who is the biggest maker of psychiatric drugs, and funded by NAMI. And so I thought, well, what the heck is this? You know, who are these Active Minds people? So I went over to the building where they said their office was located, you know, as a student activity. And they didn't exist. And I asked the desk clerk in the union about them. They'd never heard of them. They're a quote-unquote outside agitator. They're not a student group. And another, of course, they're hanging around the campus, and they're holding different events for people. But they're very, very well-funded. And when you look at other campus groups like for gender equality or climate change, there's no money. They don't have fancy T-shirts and fancy displays and fancy Facebooks and PR because they're not funded by Big Pharma. You know, so Active Minds is a very insidious group because these two suicides that happened here in Evanston, we do not know what drugs, if any, of these kids were on. We don't know if they were newly on a psychoactive drug that made them suicidal or if they had just gone off, because the medical examiner report and the health service reports, they're not going to be given to the public. But I hypothesize, you know, that they could very well have been on the very drugs these groups are saying they were denied. And these groups, and I'm sure you've seen this, Peter, they still have a war against the black box warning for suicide that dates back to 2007. And these groups who work for Big Pharma want to sell 3- and 4-digit dollar drugs a month, you know, expensive drugs a month, they still contend that the warnings are the reason for the suicide, that if people weren't scared away from SSRIs, we would have less suicides, which is such an insult to the intelligence. And I wrote recently in a column, that's like saying people are obese because diet drugs are restricted. I mean, it's just stupid. You know, so these people are killing themselves because they have an SSRI deficiency. So you know, that's their contention. And speaking again of the New York Times, just within the last week, they had some psychiatrist or professor of psychiatry claim the same thing, that you know, if these warnings are scaring patients and doctors, well, yeah, that's a definition of a warning. I mean, you know, so they're still battling for their market share of antidepressants.
I'm a legal expert in a case right now where the doctors... who bought those experts, told him that while there might be some risk for suicide from these drugs, there was a greater risk from depression of suicide. They didn't
right.
even, he didn't even make the connection of whether or not the drugs actually can prevent suicide. I mean, how can a drug that is known to be causing suicide and not preventing it be good for people who are suicidal? It just doesn't make any sense at all. And some vague claim that somehow the drug is gonna save more suicides than it causes is not possible, because the controlled clinical trials simply show it doesn't prevent suicides, it causes them. That's a scientific fact. And yet people get so mystified about all this that they're imagining that the drug is preventing more suicides while it's causing them. It makes no sense at all.
Well, Peter, you know, I believe it's criminal. Four people that I've been very close to have killed themselves not too long ago. And I think if this is criminal, literally making money by killing people, I mean, it's not their intention to kill the people, but they also don't care. And so it's, you know, one very good statistic is the USA Today estimates 38,000 people a year kill themselves in the United States. And it's gone way, way up since the 1990s. It's also estimated that in some places, as many as a quarter of the population are on antidepressants. Okay, so you have these two graphs that are rising at the same time. So at the minimum, you know that the SSRIs are not helping prevent suicide. You don't really know if they're causing it. You can't know that, but you know they're not helping it. If we've never had a higher suicide rate and we've never had more people on SSRIs.
Kevin Miller's new film, Letters from Generation RX, which follows up his original film, Generation RX, he has this interview with, I said, Tom Insel, the head of NIMH, in which he says that... the drugs aren't working. Our depression rates are going up. Suicide rates are going up. Mental illness rates are going up. If you have something that cures a disease, you expect the rates to go down. They're not working. We got to do something new. Of course, what he wants new, being the head of NIMH, is more money for brain research.
You know, I've written about him quite a bit. But, you know, you in your more recent book... I'm sorry?
You want to say more about him?
Well, it wouldn't be, he has made a lot of pro-drug remarks for children to be on drugs. And I don't have in front of me the columns I've written about him, but, you know, I do not have a great respect for him or Nora Volkow.
No.
You know, in the two leaders of institutes are, in my opinion, working for Big Pharma, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think it's
been.
Real. Pardon me?
Yeah, I'm sure they always have been.
You know, I'd like to speak for a second about Nora Volkow, because she is the head of the NIDA, National Institute on Drug Abuse.
NIDA.
And, pardon me?
NIDA for folks.
Okay.
NIDA.
And, you know, I've written a lot and have a lot of... background in in addiction and alcoholism, drug addiction, and I know a lot about the problem. And so she actually is promoting a vaccine for alcoholism and drug addiction. Well, anyone who knows addicts and alcoholics knows that they're not going to take a vaccine because it's a disease of denial. Nobody. That's why antabuse didn't work, you know. And as you've said in your wonderful book that I just am reading now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, the psychopharmaceutical complex wants to cast all these problems as brain chemistry. And you know, I so disagree with that. I know you do. And, you know, the idea, if you're drinking too much or you're hooked on drugs, that is a mental, physical, and emotional problem. It's not a brain chemistry problem. And, you know, some of that is isolation. You know, like we talked just a minute about incel saying this isn't working. A big cause of depression is how isolated everyone is from, you know, community. And that's a factor you see in self-help groups for alcoholism and drug addiction. But the idea of finding a vaccine that will cure alcoholism, I mean, that is lunacy. We, you know, and not to mention testing it on primates who don't really have alcoholism. I mean, the whole thing is, it would be laughable if it weren't many, many millions of dollars in our top government institutes.
Yes. It's quite astonishing what we've done. If you find this conversation interesting, folks, last week I had Bob Whitaker on, and the author of Anatomy of an Epidemic and Mad in America, and we really delved into how corrupting this is of our society, how it actually disrupts or cancels out all of the educational processes of Western civilization, all that we learn from novels and psychology and anthropology and so on about how human suffering, you know, is endemic to us, but how we can try to deal with it through relationship and improved social activities and through spirituality and all these complex issues surrounding human beings and our suffering, and they just wipe it away and say, let's take a drug. Is it no surprise that these drugs are literally poisons that are doing nothing more than destroying brains and minds? Long term, more and more, the evidence accumulates for permanent brain damage from every class of psychiatric drugs and permanent blunting of emotions, of sexuality. So it's just so important
you're so right. Before I was a reporter, I worked in advertising. And so I know a lot about how it works and, more importantly, that it does work. And a really sad point in our culture was when they approved the direct-to-consumer advertising, because it does work. And you do convince people not just that they want Zoloft or something, but also that they have the disease you're advertising. And they're actually selling disease, as many people have observed. And you see it not
Martha,
just in the psychiatric.
We're going to go to break in a minute.
Okay.
Quickly, how do people get in touch with you before we come back after the break?
Oh, my gosh. The main place that my columns run is opednews.com. And I have a piece up today on this suicide front group, opednews.com.
All right. Martha Rosenberg we're talking to, folks. We'll go to break in a few seconds, and we'll be back after some music and talk to go on and discuss some interesting stuff. Let's go to break. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, happily back again with Martha Rosenberg. You know, folks, Martha's a really good example of how a person, without submitting to the establishment, can go ahead and find really excellent ways to be a scientific researcher and reporter and to just do a great public service. And maybe, Martha, maybe a little later in the show or in a later show, you can talk a little bit about how you've gone about doing this. But during the break, you had mentioned Teen Screen, that this thing is coming back again. Tell the folks about Teen Scream, I should call it, and what's happening.
Well, Teen Screen was a program that sought early intervention with children to find out if they were, quote-unquote, mentally ill or if they needed drugs. And it was unabashedly hooked up with Big Pharma and the people who ran it. It was really a pharma-funded initiative that was, I think, at Columbia, if I'm correct. And
it was at Columbia, and the woman who headed it was the former head of NAMI. Boy, she gets around poisoning people.
It was just evil
by
to
the
core. Because
let me just say, I think I'm objective about NAMI because I was talking about their being AstroTurf before they attacked me. But NAMI is an organization that went after my medical license because of remarks I made on Oprah Winfrey back in the mid-'80s. And boy, was that a mistake, because it got Ginger angry because she was just doing other things. She was going to school, getting A's, getting awards, doing photography, getting awards. And she decided, well, she better just partner with me and use her skills. And so NAMI aroused Ginger. And also, we had such a huge victory against them with the medical board apologizing to me for attacking a freedom of speech issue that I got my first book, mass market book published, Toxic Psychiatry. But that's my background with this violent, vicious group, NAMI. go ahead.
Peter, I wish you could tell them the little anecdote where you had to testify in front of the committee and one of the experts had never heard of TD and how you were. Do you remember that anecdote?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God, yes.
Can you tell that?
Well, I'm sitting in front of folks at the time, in front of 25 or 30 members of the Maryland AMA, the American Medical Association in Maryland, because they're the ones who work for the board, licensure board, and make recommendations on what to do about doctors who are accused of things. Clearly, this shouldn't even have gone that far because it was freedom of speech, and what I said on Oprah Winfrey was very good, and she defended me. Sort of halfway through, an OBGYN says, and you're talking about brain damage and psychiatric drugs, doctor. And I said to him, yes, do you know what tardive dyskinesia is? I turned the tables on him, and he said, no.
I said, no.
Well, may I give a lecture to this group, just a seminar, brief seminar, on tardive dyskinesia, so you'll know just why I have to go public on these criticisms of drugs, because even the profession doesn't know about it. And the only psychiatrist in the group said, yes, doctor, let's hear a seminar on tardive dyskinesia. Turned out he's an old-time guy who was really into helping people. They don't exist hardly in the profession. So I ended up giving them a talk on tardive dyskinesia. It completely floored them. They got all upset. It was like the bully had been punched in the nose, and they caved in.
Well, that was, and you were so before your time with some of these things. You were attacked really early. Other people have been attacked since then. But, you know, tardive dyskinesia is a terrible stigma that does not. It's stigmatizing, and I don't believe it goes away, does it? I think it's permanent.
Well, The good news is that although more and more children are getting tardive dyskinesia because we're giving more and more children the neuroleptic drugs like Seroquel, Abilify, Zyprexa, and Risperdal, it's right. The antipsychotic drugs, folks, that cause these terrible abnormal movements that are disfiguring. They're almost always disfiguring, sometimes horribly painful, and often associated with some degree of cognitive losses. The good news is that children sometimes recover fully. In adults,
I'm happy to.
Yeah, sometimes. In adults, the whole key is stopping it immediately, because if you stop it at the first sign of an abnormal movement, you have a good chance, maybe a third of the time, this may just go away. But psychiatrists don't stop it. What they do is give more of the drug often, and that just suppresses the movement, makes it worse and worse. Those cases become permanent. If you don't stop it at the first sign, you're creating a horrible lifelong disorder.
I remember the drugs Haldol, Sorazine, Stilazine, and Melaril, which were at the time the TD, the antipsychotics that produced a stigmatizing TD, and these more recent, these so-called atypicals, were presented as not causing that, and that was a lie. Either they didn't test them long enough, or they just lied, but, you know, they do cause it.
It's got to be a lie, because I knew immediately they were going to cause TD, because right there in the label, in the physician's desk reference describing each of these drugs, it said they were potent dopamine 2 blockers. And mm-hmm. if you're blocking mm-hmm. dopamine, you're causing TD. Every known drug that blocks mm-hmm. dopamine causes TD, whatever the drug's mm-hmm. being used for. It could be Reglan being used for, to help with the digestion and diabetes. It causes TD.
Right.
So, I mean, it was obvious. Only gross self-interest could have kept everybody using these drugs and the manufacturers of it from knowing they were going to cause TD.
So I think it's very interesting that these are stigmatizing drugs. And NAMI, who we just talked about, has huge campaigns about destigmatizing mental illness, which
right.
they put them on these drugs. I mean, what an irony. And there is no, you know, the barriers to treatment and destigmatizing or the stigma, are there two marketing initiatives to sell these drugs? I really feel it's unethical what they do, because those who aren't in the field you and I are in, they don't know, and they can buy this stuff. They buy these easy answers. And I've said this a lot. I don't know if you would agree, because I'm certainly not a psychiatrist, but I think that they've defined depression up so that now when you have a bad day and you have real reasons like money problems, job problems, marriage problems, you're depressed. And everyone wants to feel good, but
no doubt about it, Marla. In fact, it goes even worse than that. The marketing has been so convincing that your average GP will give you one of these drugs for fatigue. I mean, even nerves. I mean, it's just really bad what's going on. But giving them for any purpose is bad, because they really only help depression by sometimes giving you a little euphoria in the beginning, which is a very bad sign because it can lead to mania, and more often by just blunting your emotions. That's how they work. And they.
So what NAMI has done, and it's many groups that play out of the same playbook, like Active Minds for the young kids, they're glamorizing mental illness. And they're making money off it, and they're convincing people they are mentally ill. And I can see in the last 10, 20 years that they have defined these things up so that anybody can look at the symptoms and say, oh, that's me, I need a drug. And, on the campuses, there's so many issues when you're 19. You know, you're going to have mood swings. And this doesn't mean you have a clinical depression, but what NAMI and Active Minds and some other groups like the Red Flags do is they preach early intervention, which is another sneaky lie, because First of all, these symptoms could easily go away. If you're just growing up, you're 19, you know. But if you're on these drugs or not, as you well put in your book about, you know, the psychiatric drug withdrawal, if you're on the drug, you're not going to know you didn't need it anymore. You're going to have symptoms from the drug. They're going to add other drugs. And you're a lifelong customer for Big Pharma. And that's, you know, that's what happens. And you just see it all the time. And so I've been covering the active minds and how they're going for the younger people, the college age. There's a quote from Shire, you know, who was the big ADHD drug maker. And this was a conference call, but we somehow got a hold of it. And they actually lamented that they were losing their customers when the customers would go to college and they would go off their Ritalin, you know. So they really want, these drug makers really want the college people. And so this idea of early intervention, it's ill-conceived anyway. But when you're talking about early intervention with children, and so Teen Screen, getting back to that, was designed by NAMI and the other drug makers to flag a kid that could be put on these drugs. And, you know, which I shouldn't say this because I'm sure listeners have kids that are on these drugs, but to a certain extent, their life is going to go in a different direction. It's not going to be a normal life unless this kid can get off the drugs. But the whole early intervention movement, you know, was a pharma marketing strategy that was very, very successful. Now, Teen Screen was shut down in 2013, and nobody knows why. But in its place is a group called organization called Red Flags International. Well, they're on 100 campuses. They're really doing almost the exact thing that Teen Screen did, except it's younger. It's young kids now, and the Red Flags is the kid having trouble focusing? Does the kid cry? Does the kid whine? You know, anything that might be a normal child behavior is pathologized to get these kids on drugs. Well, I called the executive director of this group, and I said, who funds you, you know? Cause, and not to be cynical, but who funds you? And she said, well, we were set up by Mental Health America, but we're now some kind of foundation. Well, Mental Health America, you know, was investigated by Congress, okay? And they were funded by Lilly and Bristol Myers Squibb, Mental Health America. And I might add that Teen Screen was also investigated by Congress. So, I mean, it's not too hard to find this. You don't have to dig real hard. And so this Red Flags is a new early intervention program. And, you know, I always tell people, if you want to know if the message you're getting is from grassroots people who care or Big Pharma, just look at how slick their materials are. If they're slick, it's Big Pharma. I mean, that's really as simple as it gets. And so if you go, if you look at the image apps like Pinterest or Instagram or Google Images, and you Google for mental illness or depression, you'll see all these posters that actually sell it through these groups like NAMI and Active Minds. And they'll say, for example, one thing they love to say is 1 out of 4 people has a mental illness, 1 out of 5 children has a mental illness. Yeah, because they sell drugs. And so they glamorize mental illness and try to convince people, especially these kids on the campus, that no, you're not just growing up, you're mentally ill, and you better hurry up and get on these drugs. Well, that is just criminal.
I'm so glad you're blowing the whistle on this stuff again. So much evil is perpetrated by the pharmaceutical industry in collusion, first and foremost, with my colleagues in psychiatry, but with all the professional organizations and pretty much all the specialties. It's impossible to keep up with what for one person to keep up with what they're doing. And I'm really glad you're in particular following these phony AstroTurf organizations.
Well, it's hard to keep up with them, and they're so slick, Peter. I looked at their images, and they have this, you know, young girl. She's maybe 16, and her face is painted, and she looks so cute, you know. And she says, "This is their big campaign is this is what mental illness looks like." And they're literally selling mental illness. They're telling normal people growing up that you're mentally ill, you know, and you need to be on these drugs. And we know that just so few people, I know from your book about the drug withdrawal, so few people get back to where they were before the drugs.
Yeah, that's right. There's just no doubt about it. And again, my wonderful listeners, you know, you can't come off these drugs cold turkey if you've been on them for months or years. And if you're on multiple drugs, expect to take a very long time to come off of them. Because it's dangerous to go on, and it's dangerous to go off. It's dangerous to change doses because the brain tries to adapt. And then when you change the dose, the brain is facing a new challenge again. And it has nothing to do with psychology. It doesn't have to do with you as a person. These are neurologic, biologic, toxic states created by taking the drug and then transformed into another kind of toxic state of withdrawal when you come off. But you can, it always helps no matter what one is dealing with to have a support system, and you should have a good support system and come off very, very slowly. And I try to describe that in my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, which Martha has been kind to mention. Martha, when we were talking, you've just been kind all day here, but you mentioned guilt, shame, and anxiety, and you told me on when we first started chatting off the air that book's been helpful to you. I'm so glad to hear that.
Well, it certainly has. I don't know how many listeners remember Jonathan Bradshaw, but he was the first thinker that I was aware of that really addressed shame as a huge human emotion that's often ignored. And your book addresses, you know, guilt, shame, and anxiety, which are, you know, maybe the triad of Western civ or something, but, you know, they're so common, and they're kind of, they're treated with drugs rather than, you know, other, like compassion from other people or therapy, because I know that talk therapy is, you know, so people don't want to do that anymore, and they don't want to, you know, dig deep. And I often think about that, too. They say, well, talk therapy is so expensive. Well, so are drugs like Abilify, which are like $1,200 a month. You know, which is more expensive? But what I liked in your book so far, I'm not done with it, is this idea of the re-traumatization. When somebody's shamed, they're going to cease doing things because they're afraid of being more shamed. And I found that so interesting, and it's also sometimes called re-traumatized, but the idea that your aspiration level will actually change. You're just going to kind of give up on yourself. And I found that really interesting as an aspect of shame. And, you know, I think Bradshaw used to call it the master emotion that would shut down all the other emotions. And then you talked about the how psychiatry wants to tell you your brain is kind of your problem, or it doesn't belong to you. This whole idea of the medical model of brain, you know, which then leaves you, you know, open to being given drugs. You know, this idea of the you have a brain that turns you against your own brain, you know, and you write about that. And then you also had something in there that I found interesting, though I'm not psychotic most usually, but the idea that if a person who's involved in psychosis can connect to one person, then they're going to calm down. And you see that a lot in these self-help drug programs where somebody who's been so isolated and so in their own head, and if they can connect to another person, they start getting better.
Absolutely. It's the secret to life. I mean, life begins with the mother and the child. And the mother nurses the child with her body, hopefully, and we become human beings in relation to our mother or our nurturer, whoever it is. And in fact, all the other people around us only matter mostly in how they support the mother in helping us grow. It doesn't take a village to raise a child. It takes a village to help the mother raise the child. And for the rest of our lives, much of our disturbance and anguish will relate to the quality of that nurturing early in life, and then to who else comes along to help us grow and transform ourselves and helps us often in rising above some of the leftovers of guilt, shame, and anxiety from our upbringing and from evolution, since I think they come first from biological evolution. Then they get stimulated like instincts. They get triggered in childhood. And throughout our lives, one other person can make all the difference in the world to us. Don't forget that, folks. Some therapist tells you first you've got to get well before you can make a relationship. It's just not true. Or if someone says to you that, listen, you've got to get yourself better rather than turning to help from a loved one.
Wow, talk about backwards, huh?
Yeah.
It's such a cliche, but love does heal. And you can see in these self-help drug and alcohol programs, people who come in and they've been living under a bridge, you know. And you watch this, you know, where they have reached a point of shame where they don't want to be around other people because they think they're going to be attacked. And you talk about that in the book about being attacked. And then they discover they're not attacked. And, you know, and then the healing starts. And it's, you know, the people thing has so gone away from healing. It's like we're going to heal with an app and a pill, you know. And don't they talk about these poorer countries where maybe here too, because I never had kids, where they have this attachment parenting where the child is never put down?
Well, probably for 2 million years of our development, starting as these little bipeds on our 2 feet just barely getting out of the trees, until only recently, say maybe 10,000 years ago, we were raised with nursing on demand, usually until 3, 4, 5 years old, almost certainly, because we couldn't eat most of the foods that were available then, and because often there wasn't food available, and because we were nomadic, we were small bands of nomads for the 2 million years of our development.
Yeah.
And so mom carried the food in her body because you didn't have a lot of ability to carry stuff on your back. You didn't have pack animals. We evolved as a creature that is closely dependent upon other creatures. Now, one of the studies that I think you may have been hinting at has shown, and it didn't want to show this at all because it was a World Health Organization study, and they're in the pocket of psychiatry and the drug companies. A series of these studies have shown that people who have a psychotic break get much better if they're living in a third world country. First,
oh my goodness.
First, because they don't take the drugs as mm-hmm. long or as often and not as available. And second, they have extended families. And mm-hmm. the secret to recovering from psychosis is to make connections with people. It's not to be isolated, put in a hospital, drugged, called names, told you're a schizophrenic, told you got a lifelong disease and you got to take drugs, which, by the way, as you know, Martha, just adds to the humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
My view, Martha, you may not know this, schizophrenia, so-called schizophrenia, these early psychotic breakdowns, I think they're basically overwhelmed with humiliation, a lack of connectivity to others, and then just destroyed by feelings of being different and being shameful and not being of value and They are almost humiliation attacks. And the answer to getting over that, among other things, is to have one person who treats you with dignity and love and respect and tenderness, respects your boundaries, doesn't diagnose you, doesn't call you names. That's the whole secret. And, of course, because of psychiatrists, you get called names. Yeah.
Well, and your empathic therapy is based on that, right?
Yeah, the whole concept of empathic therapy isn't my therapy or your therapy. It's bringing together people who put a caring relationship and put empathy, caring, respect, treasuring of the individual as the foremost importance in the way they work with people. So it's really about any approach that starts out with, you know, respecting, empowering, caring about, even loving within boundaries, within rigid boundaries, loving the other human being that we're trying to help.
Well, you know, I'd like to ask you one last question if we have a little time left, because you've been doing this wonderful work and overall the world is getting worse and worse. Do you see any hope for your profession?
I don't see much hope for psychiatry any more than, say, for any other heavily invested oppressive institution. It won't give in on its own. It's got all this money at stake. It's got authority at stake. And furthermore, psychiatrists don't know how to do therapy anymore, so they can't even compete with the psychotherapists, of which there are far hundreds of thousands compared to, say, 40 or 50,000 psychiatrists. So psychiatry's dug itself in a hole. It's going to have to be like the fall of the Berlin Wall. It's going to have to be that people stop obeying, stop going, stop granting authority to psychiatry. So the work you do addressing the public is the single most important kind of work that we can do.
You know, every time
I make sense to you, Martha?
Pardon me?
Make sense to you?
Well, absolutely. That they're going to respond to the milieu they're in, and if the public challenges some of this specious authority, I do hear parents saying, "No, you're not putting my kid on a drug." You know, that
kind
of thing.
That's what has to be done. They won't change. We have to change, folks.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to break. I'm finishing up with Martha Rosenberg. She's an investigative reporter. Her book is Born with a Junk Food Deficiency. Get online, find her, read her blogs. Thank you, Martha, for being on the show.
Well, thank you so much, Peter, and for your good work. Bye now.
Bye-bye.